Hello and welcome to Games with Garfield. I'm your host, Jessica Price, and I have with me Richard Garfield.
Hello.
And Scaff Elias.
Hi.
Where's Tyler?
I'm not sure that I care.
So we've got a new host.
Yeah, Tyler did good work for us, and he has moved away, and we replaced him with somebody just better. In terms of, she's got a much nicer voice than Tyler did.
Oh, poor Tyler. I liked his voice. So it's my understanding that he has moved up to Vancouver to work for my employer, Microsoft, a.k.a. the Borg.
Yeah. Richard and I occasionally talk to Microsoft people, and one day they swapped one Microsoft employee for another on us, and now we've got you.
We all have a chip implanted that makes us basically the same, so hopefully you won't notice too much of a difference.
Yeah, just occasional pauses where we download new drivers to you.
Yeah, I was going to hope that we did notice much of a difference. So our new host has a background in the gaming industry, so we'll turn the tables a little bit, and Richard and I will do a little bit of work ourselves.
So you're a gal, so probably like casual games, like Bejeweled. Is that the way you go?
I have occasionally played those games while I was on long and boring phone calls, but no, I like first-person shooters, I like RPGs, I know. The thing about being a girl in the gaming industry is everybody assumes that you have magical knowledge of how to create that elusive game that will finally capture the female market, and I don't. I play boy games, so unfortunately, I'm not the savior of the girl game.
And what games have you been playing recently?
Recently, I've been playing a lot of Mass Effect.
Mass Effect 2?
Just Mass Effect.
I'm really?
Catching up. I loved the original Halo, although I did not like Halo 2 and 3. More recently, my favorites were Portal and Bioshock, because I thought both of those did a good job.
Portal was amazing.
I loved Portal. I'm not actually that violent. I enjoy the mechanics of first-person shooters. That came out a little wrong. But I really liked Portal because it doesn't seem to me that it should be a constraint on design that the only thing you can shoot in a first-person shooter is, you know, bullets or fireballs or destructive things. I loved being able to shoot portals, and it seems like there is a lot of unexplored territory for doing really cool things with video games there. So
I was really happy to have that be my at the time, 9-year-old's first shooter.
Nice.
So he loved that. I thought it was an amazing game. I'm doing a bit of the catch-up also. I did it with Bioshock because Bioshock 2 came out, and so I thought, I never finished Bioshock 1, so I went back and finished it, and now I was thinking of doing the same thing with Mass Effect.
Unfortunately, I don't know, where did you leave off with Bioshock 1 before you came back to it?
I made it through the medical pavilion. I didn't make it much further than that, so I didn't make it very far.
Are we allowed to talk about spoilers, or...? Do we try and be spoiler-free?
We don't. You can sort of tell if you've listened to our podcast. We don't care that much about our listeners, or I guess we don't care enough. We don't care enough about our listeners, but we will say spoiler alert, and now go ahead.
So, spoiler alert, I thought that the game really went downhill after you killed Andrew Ryan.
Oh, right.
Like, it seemed like they cared so much about the storyline and the design up until the point where you kill him, and after that, it just seemed like they just wanted to finish it.
Tacked on, it felt like they had to tack on an extra, 15 hours of gameplay or something.
To get the gameplay up. It's like, oh, hey, well, the story's done. Our gameplay numbers aren't high enough.
Also, it felt like the voice acting wasn't as good after that.
I know.
Like, the person who was guiding you before then switched his voice completely.
I know. And he got tired of doing the Irish accent.
Yeah, and then he went over to, what was his new one? Was it?
He was Atlas, and then we found out he was actually Fontaine. Anyway. And yeah, one of the things I loved about it, bringing up the voice acting, is how much of the story was told through, the mooks. You know, the random people that you would sneak up on and have to kill because they would try and kill you. But as you were sneaking up on them, they'd be having their own little arguments with other people or be muttering to themselves as they looked through something. So you felt like you were in a real city with people that had been living their own lives and having their own little dramas. And unfortunately, you had to kill them. But
yeah. Well, no, the atmosphere in Bioshock was outstanding. It's just really original, that alternative Ayn Rand, underwater 50s science fiction. It's really fresh.
So what other games do you play?
I like board games. I like card games. I'm only now coming, I feel strange admitting this, sitting next to Richard Garfield, but I'm only now coming to Magic.
Oh, good. Glad to hear it.
And yeah, it's a good game.
What other card games?
I like actual card games, like poker deck card games. Uh-huh. So I had a grandmother that knew an endless amount of card games because I'm originally from Wisconsin and there's not much else to do in the winter. You can't go outside, so you stay inside and play cards. I like board games. Settlers of Catan, it's not really a board game, it's more of a card game, but a lot of Dominion. I've been playing a lot of Mystery of the Abbey, which, you know, is basically Clue, but cool because it's...
Yeah, I've got it up there. I haven't played it. I've played it, like, once. I'd like to play more. That's my shelf of games I'm interested in playing in the near future, so...
So it's hard for me because I'm with, like, disposable game pieces. I get to be, like, a total pack rat. I'm afraid of using them up. And it has these beautifully designed disposable sheets that... help you eliminate suspects.
Oh, yeah, like the Clue sheets.
Yeah, and so I love playing it. I'm kind of addicted to it, and yet every time I play it, it's a struggle. I'm like, one less sheet. Like, I've cut down by one the number of times I can play this game.
You can't, like, use a copier on them, right?
Well, if I had a copier.
Yeah, okay. You can borrow mine. Or Microsoft's.
Or Microsoft's.
Yeah, that's right. They don't mind, right?
Well, they might. I don't know. You can't, the weird thing at Microsoft is you can't make a black and white copy. I have yet to figure out how to tell it, no, it's fine. You don't have to reproduce it in, like, photographic level color.
On glossy paper. Everything's glossy paper at Microsoft.
I just want to, you know.
Well, they've got to compete with Google somehow.
That's right. And so what are the games?
Those are my current crop. You know, there's a lot of stuff I played once with people to try it.
What do you play, let's say, on Wednesday nights?
On Wednesday nights, I play Pathfinder, which is a pen and paper RPG. Scaff here is actually in my group. He plays a ranger named Elsid. I play a rogue named Elena.
Oh, please tell us about your characters.
Yeah, really, that's where we cut off this discussion right here. Yeah, I don't like, you know, I don't like when people tell me their character names, and so therefore I won't tell them.
Not like, you know, yesterday we killed this boss and you're not believable.
Yeah, no, when someone comes up to you and says,
name.
Hello, I play Dungeons and Dragons, my character's name is Beldar, a 5th level gnome illusionist. Like, right there, you're well on your way to having me fake some horrible excuse. to leave the room and or state.
It's interesting because...
And I love playing Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah, I love Pathfinder, but it's my first long-term RPG, which is... I've had many encounters in my life where I almost played an RPG, but this, other than a game I was briefly in with Tyler, this is my first pen and paper RPG experience. So, you know, being somebody who's story-focused and who likes games that let the players... drive the story. I'm very enchanted with it.
And what about professionally, game-wise?
So professionally, I've had sort of a wacky career, I guess. I've only been in the games industry for about 2.5 years. I started out doing freelance work for a guy named Jordan Weissman, who, if you're a gamer, you may recognize as the guy who created, oh boy, Crimson Skies, Battletech, MechWarrior, Shadowrun,
Mage Knight,
HeroClix. And he also invented this genre of game called the alternate reality game, actually, while he was at Microsoft.
So what exactly is an alternate reality game?
So an alternate reality game is an attempt to create a form of gaming in which the play space is not constrained by a single medium. So you don't boot up a program on your computer like, you know, Civilization 3 and play the entire game within that program. You also don't get out a board game and move pieces around. The real world is your play space, and, you know, it's not an RPG. You're not playing a character. You're yourself. A lot of times they take the form of mysteries, and as with many art forms in their early stage, they tend to get used a lot for advertising, although there have been plenty of examples that have been done for their own sake. The first major
commercial,
fully formed ARG was a game called The Beast, which a guy named Jordan Weissman did while he was at Microsoft to help promote the movie AI. And The Beast was this massive mystery where you could be looking at the AI poster and you would notice that the date that the movie was coming out, each of the numbers had a bunch of little notches in it. And if you counted up the notches on each number, you'd find that they spelled out a phone number. Call the phone number, you get a voicemail for a professor at this university. And that's when you start noticing that things are a little weird. She's a professor at Bangalore World University, which has campuses in, I think, the United States, India, and the moon. So.
Okay, yeah, that would ring
some alarm bells, yeah. So the thing was, this murder mystery that you suddenly found yourself up to your knees in was taking place in, I think it was 2142, shortly before the events of the movie AI. And because of some little time warp, their internet was coming back in time and interfacing with our internet. So there were sites for all the different organizations that were involved with this mystery. If a phone number was mentioned, it was real. If an email address was mentioned, it was real. You know, you'd email it, and sometimes you'd get a personalized response. Sometimes there's an autoresponder. So basically, it was a game as archaeology.
Games as archaeology?
Yeah, so the idea with the alternate reality game is that you write a story and you create all the sort of ephemera that would exist if it actually happened. So, you know, letters, voicemail messages, emails, and so on. And then you actually throw out the story itself so that the players go and they have all these artifacts that are left over from the story and they have to piece them together and try and figure out what the story was. Much in the same way that an archaeologist digs up a broken vase and tries to piece it together and, you know, argues with other archaeologists about what it meant to the culture. And so, in a way, the archaeologist, I'm sure that some of them would dispute this, but in a way, the archaeologist is creating a story of what that vase meant to the culture, because, you know, a lot of it is speculative. And in the same way, the players, after putting together the artifacts and trying to figure out what they mean, create the story of what they
meant.
Yeah, that reminds me of how we were writing stories for Magic in the early days. Our experiences, we felt like there ought to be some sort of story with the sets of cards, but we didn't know how to do that because players weren't going to receive the cards in any particular order, and so it seemed kind of weird that you'd have a narrative delivered to you in a random order.
Yeah, that's the same design problem we
Yeah, and not just in a random order, but with cards, we had an extra constraint that on the internet, I guess you didn't have, because you could put as big a, you know, whatever thing you wanted. But our chunk was, you know, we've got two sentences.
Right.
Two sentences tiny. Only in or one sentence, if it's a long sentence, it delivered in a random order.
You know, that seems like a really great topic for another podcast.
You mean how narratives are revealed in games?
Creating non-linear narratives for games and, you know, what you do with the design constraints.
Or choking down the linear narratives that they force on you.
Exactly. And, you know,
yeah, how to swallow a narrative forced on you in a game.
Well, and it ties back nicely to
alcohol.
You know, talking about games like BioShock that, you know, are similar in that they can control to a certain extent what area you go to when, but not where in that area, and not always what characters you encounter. So it seems like that would be a really great...
Yes, narratives and games are... that's a great topic.
So I'll give you a little teaser.
An unhappy marriage. Narratives and games, an unhappy marriage. But a marriage nonetheless.
So anyway, getting back to ARGs, I got into it because I played the second one.
Which was?
It was a game called Isle of Bees, which was
the one I heard of.
So it was a promotion for Halo 2, and I had a friend call me up at work and be like, you have to leave work early. And I was like, why? She's like, because at 5:35, a payphone half a block from your house is going to ring, and you have to go answer it and give a password. I was like, this isn't some sort of corporate drug ring, is it? What is this? And she's like, no, it's a game, and hundreds of thousands of people are depending on you individually. I was like, okay. So I left.
That's literally how you got into it? Is someone called you up and said, you need to go to this payphone? Because they happen to know where you live. And
she was my friend.
Yeah, and then what I'm saying, they had located where the payphone would be, and it was like, okay, who do we know that can get there?
So the game
Since it was in Wisconsin, it was you, your grandmother, or the cat.
Right. No, actually, I got there, and there were like 30 boys standing around the payphone, but they were all afraid to answer it. So I just walked up there, picked it up, gave the password, and they're all like, oh, God, what's happening? So I... you know, suddenly I was hearing a, I think, 2-minute clip of this War of the Worlds style radio drama, and it was exciting and it was compelling and I was hooked. So, you know, I got involved enough that after the game was over, the creators actually contacted me and we started talking and we started brainstorming, and eventually they offered me a job and I came out here to Seattle, Washington to work for Jordan's newest company, which was a startup called Smith & Tinker. And the idea behind Smith & Tinker was that there are all sorts of so-called connected toys out there, you know, toys that supposedly interact with the internet, but they don't really. You know, you buy Webkinz. Either of you do Webkinz?
Some of my kids may or may not.
Okay. So, you know, you buy Webkinz, you scan the code or put in the code on the collar, and, you know, you get your virtual version of the animal, but at that point, the stuffed animal that you bought has ceased to interact with the internet. It's, you know, now just a normal stuffed animal.
It's like a seed husk.
Yeah,
once the
exactly.
seeds are spent.
Yeah, then you yeah. have, I mean, it's a furry and cute seed husk, but yeah. As far as the internet is concerned, it's useless once you've used the code. So we were trying to create toys that encouraged what we referred to as a virtual cycle of play, in which you'd use your toy would interact with the internet, you'd go online and play a game and come back and use your toy again and continue to cycle through this play pattern. And now I'm at Microsoft.
So the the alternate reality games sound a lot like puzzle hunts. SCAF got me into the MIT puzzle hunt a long time ago. Was it 94?
Probably, yeah, about then. Something. Might have been 93, something like that.
So you were the pusher.
I was, because my friends pushed me.
So it's all first taste.
That's
this
right.
free kid.
That's right. We want some slave labor, so you you grab some people. So Richard and I drove up and participated in this puzzle hunt. And I think, did we win the first one we did or the second one?
You know, I don't remember. I think we might have won the first.
You won the first one you did?
It was the first or second. I forget. Maybe I participated once and then brought Richard in the next
yeah.
year or something. Anyway, we either won the first or second one, which is you're sort of proud when you win the MIT
yeah.
mystery hunt. And then all of a sudden you find out that the prize is you've got to make the hunt for next year, and you become significantly less proud.
Oh, no. That's what I really love.
That's
that.
The fun part.
Until I began to work with the politics of having 20 people who really want to make a puzzle hunt and leave their mark on it, negotiating what puzzles to make.
Yeah. And for me, it's you really want to do it like you really want to be a professional basketball player, and then you realize it takes a lot of time to practice to be a professional basketball player, and it takes a lot of time and effort to construct one of these hunts.
Yeah. So the MIT puzzle hunt has evolved a lot since we began it. Began playing it. We went several times, and then we've also participated in the Microsoft puzzle hunts. And
so, which one did you like better?
It's hard to say. I think in theory I like the MIT one better, but in practice I've enjoyed the Microsoft ones better. And that's just because the MIT is one of the few puzzle hunts that has stuck to this this principle of allowing arbitrarily sized teams. Once you get enough people together, and you're going to be solving the puzzles a lot faster, and then each person is less important, and the bloating of the teams in the MIT puzzle hunt was outrageous.
Yeah, not only that, but you design, I'm sure you know, you've designed puzzles. You have to design very differently if you think you're going to have thousands of people working together on solving it than if you're going to have, you know, one or two.
Yeah, and certainly the MIT ones are never, you know, quite that big. The one really good thing about the MIT format is that there's no, you know, possibility of cheating because, whatever, you can have as many people as you want, you can ask anyone you want, you can call anyone around the world, and so it's nice in that way. And then we eventually joined a big team, and we won again relatively recently, five years ago, maybe.
Over 100 people on the team we played last, and it was, we're experienced enough puzzlers that we got a reasonable amount of action there, but it's hard to imagine that everybody in the team got their money's worth, so
yeah.
to speak. And it also is pretty frustrating, you know, working on a puzzle for a long time and then finding, well, there's, you know, six guys upstairs who have been working on that puzzle too, and you failed to coordinate.
Yeah.
But it is also part of the charm. I mean, there is some charm to that also, just the fact that it becomes less about puzzling and more about management. I mean, just having a management team, which is dealing with food and making sure communication is going right. There's something to be said for that. But for our, you know, just having a limit of in the hunts I've done at Microsoft, 12 people in one of them, I think. You know, that was also nice. So
what makes a good puzzle for a puzzle hunt?
But if you've got a large team, you want a really large variety of different puzzle archetypes to appeal to the different people involved, and drawing on special knowledge, because there's nothing quite like the thrill of walking around and just suddenly realizing, wow, that's a collection of the 60s collectible that I happen to have at home, and suddenly you're king for the day.
The creators of the team that worked on The Beast was pretty much the same team that worked on Isle of Bees, and they joked that the solution for The Beast was, you know, oh my gosh, I get it because I'm a xenobiologist. And the solution for Isle of Bees, because it was much more location-based, was, oh my gosh, I get it because I live in Tulsa. But either way, it was, you know, something about you that in general in life is not special becomes, you know, the thing that saves the day in solving this puzzle. Yeah.
For hunts with large teams, that's really exciting and a good way to go.
Yeah, it's just like you're mentioning with the Tulsa thing. It's really cool that everyone, even on a large team, is not just has something to do, but is critical. You know, so
like it's exhilarating when you're playing. And it's like you've got the room full of people, and it's 2 o'clock in the morning because these things are done in real time, and you're playing 24 hours a day, and somebody yells out, "Who knows something about Mexican wrestlers?" Right. People straggle over from different corners of the room. I know something.
yeah. There's nothing like
my uncle was a luchador.
Yeah, there's nothing like being special to, you know, because of something that, especially something you've been made fun of, like yeah, for living in Tulsa.
Yes. Well, look at what I'm wearing under this.
Yeah.
Wow,
that could go somewhere really bad.
The other question that I often ask myself with puzzle hunts is how they could be designed better in a game sense, because oftentimes they can be very frustrating. In a game sense, you'd say, well, there's no catch-up features in this. When you fall behind, you're behind. And so many of the puzzle hunts I've played have been sort of frustrating in that regard. It doesn't really feel like you can get back into the game once you've had a misstep.
So what makes a bad puzzle then?
Ugh, lots of things. Most things, really. Most things make a bad puzzle. But I would say the primary thing that consistently makes a bad puzzle is when the puzzle creator's goal is to show how much smarter he is than the people solving the puzzle. Yeah, and that happens a surprising amount of time. I mean, the point is to solve the puzzle. It's right. Not, you know, guess what number I'm thinking of now? That's not a good puzzle.
Right. A good puzzle rather than making the people, I think, rather than making the people who are solving it think, oh my gosh, this puzzle creator was so smart. A good puzzle makes the people who solved it go, oh my gosh, I'm so smart.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely a great line to draw between a good and bad puzzle. But then we've certainly run into our fair share of just poorly crafted puzzles where, you know, there's ambiguities or
lots of noise,
misspellings or, you know, whatever. And those can often be a problem also. It's led to me quitting several times where we spend all our time working on a particular puzzle and it's really hard because they have one really bad clue. But we figure it out. And so 6 hours we've worked on it. And then they, you know, it's like, of course, the next load of errata, they sort of post the correction to the puzzle. Now,
I guess that's true. Even over and above the puzzle creator trying to show how smart he is, just errata is an easy way to make a bad puzzle.
Like, that's one of the big distinctions in puzzle hunts is how they deal with hints. right? Yeah. Hints.
Indicators.
Like the puzzles are all things which have not been seen by a lot of people. You've probably had some people play test them, but when they actually hit the playing population, there are going to be problems. And how are you going to deal with those hints? And if you hint too liberally, well, then you're punishing the people who are actually getting the puzzles. And if you hint too stingily, then people are sitting around not being able to do anything. But where the hunt has been going in recent years reminds me a lot of what you're talking about with the ARG. It's like they'll have a website which will be set up to be like a feel like a real life sort of thing, where it's got maps and so forth, and you're exploring the maps online, and they sort of bleed it out into the campus, and as you go along, you open up new sites and things, and so
it's very cool, because one of my favorite things about doing you know, actual like location based live, you know, whether it's a street game, whether it's a puzzle hunt, is that you never look at that location the same way after you've played in it. You know, like I've played games in downtown San Francisco, and that becomes a special area too, and you feel this sense of
that is really cool. Well, one thing about puzzle hunts that's I think a problem is the audience in general is so small that there's this expectation of anyone can play. And they're generally competitive, and so, you know, you wouldn't think about creating a game like, say, basketball, and say anyone in the world can come play basketball, and then you've got such a wide array of skills there. You know, eventually you would be weeded out to the people who are actually the current professional players. But it's such a ridiculous proposition to create this one game where everyone's competing against each other and expect it to work. And unfortunately, that's kind of the state of these mystery hunt puzzles. You know, I just feel bad. Because you run into a team where, you know, oh, we're a bunch of MIT undergrads. We hear this is cool. The four of us who live in the dorm together want to participate, and they just get smashed. I mean, they're, you know, because there's people that have been doing these puzzle hunts for 25 years or whatever in a row on a, I mean, not even the massive team. Some of the really good teams, say, have 20 people or whatever, and they're all professional puzzle people. I mean, those guys have no chance, and they're in the same game. And outside of these things like these puzzle hunts or ARGs, that would just be ludicrous. You would never try to set up something like that. So so audience self-selection or selection or something like that is I think, a problem with
the hunt. I mean, it's interesting. It's happening, I think, just with our culture in general, but you can totally see it in puzzle hunts, where it's now less important what you know than how good you are at searching for knowledge.
No, it's been interesting watching that evolve since our early days with the MIT puzzle hunt. At the beginning, there was very little of that, and it was like people brought their treasure troves of reference guides, like this is my collection of Shakespeare, and this is my rhyming dictionary, and so forth, and people would bring these, there'd be just this library brought, and that became just less and less important over the years, and the puzzles changed a lot too, because, you know, puzzles where you just simply anagram were pointless.
All right, so Richard and Scaff, how do you fix puzzle hunts so that they're accessible to a wider audience, so that you don't have, you know, massive teams having this unbeatable advantage over small teams? How do you fix it?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I think the first thing you probably have to look at is at least consider not making them competitive, or making them competitive in a way which leads really good people not want to crush really mediocre people, which is very difficult, of course, because people are basically evil.
but coming from the ARG side, I have to say that when people are allowed to do what they want to do, they end up collaborating rather than competing. I mean, there have been ARGs that have tried to force a competitive ethic upon the player base, and the players found their way around it.
Certainly that's another way to go, is to make it not puzzle hunt, but sort of a puzzle experience.
Well, right, but I would worry there that the problem is you know, how involved does every single person there get? If you wanted to make it just one massively collaborative effort, then I think it's a different maybe you break
game.
The problem into two tracks, right? One is the massively collaborative thing, in which case you really need to think about how do you distribute the task to everybody so that everyone's useful. And there, you know, you've got the Tulsa thing. Like, what do you know about your particular block of Tulsa? That, you know, that's certainly one way to go where you can get a massive cooperative thing going on. And then the other thing is, you know, why not, you know, why haven't the puzzle hunts in general gone the way of, say, your average computer game? Like, I don't really care that someone solved the single player Halo campaign before I did. Whatever. I mean, there's no, we're not just not compared against each other. You know, millions and millions and millions of people play these things, which are essentially puzzles, say the single player content in a lot of computer games. And yes, a very few are trying to get the achievements first or whatever, but 99% of the people just don't care to compete against the other ones.
Well, actually, two things there. You know, yes, there's a single player campaign in Halo, and yes, there's a single player campaign mode in most games, but there is also a multiplayer, which is really competitive.
Well, we know, but we can tell you that there's really a surprising amount of people just play the single player stuff.
Sure, but there's a lot of people playing multiplayer.
Sure, but okay, so okay, take sure. that away.
The you other know, thing
take
is,
that away, like BioShock, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
What percentage of people that played BioShock you think played it for the single player?
Well, there was no multiplayer
exactly.
with BioShock, so.
And it's a very successful game. So,
but the other thing is that I think one of the reasons that people play puzzle hunts is that competition is a form of connection with other people. So you don't play Halo to connect with other people. It's not a big event. It doesn't take place in a limited period of time during which everybody's doing the same thing at the same time. You know, I would compare a puzzle hunt more to, like, seeing a play or a movie premiere versus, you know, Halo is reading a book. You know, Halo you're doing alone in your house.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm asking is...
Just watch the movie in the theater.
Right.
Pardon?
You don't have to see the premiere, though. You can watch a movie afterwards and get some value out of it.
Right. Sure. If movies were limited to the number of people that went to see the premiere, it would be a much smaller thing than they are now. And I think there's something similar going on with the puzzle hunts.
Right. But what I'm saying is that I think people play puzzle hunts in a way for the same reason that people make sure to go to the midnight showing of a movie, because it's an event and they want to connect with other people.
Sure. And for a tenth of 1% of your audience, that's great.
Right. So there was a game I played which actually got me thinking along this idea of canning the puzzle hunts and doing them separately. And that was a Missing. It was like an adventure game, like the point and click type of game, except it was very much like a puzzle hunt. In fact, so much so that I actually found myself using the internet to solve the puzzles. And they had like blueprints of mosques, and it's like, what is this? And then you have to figure out what mosque it was. And,
what game is this?
This was Missing.
Missing. All right.
And it struck me that this would be a really fun game to solve in a group. I mean,
yeah.
It was balanced for one person and the internet, I guess. But
with a little help from
my friend, Mr. Google.
But there's no reason why a puzzle hunt couldn't.
Wait! Don't you mean Mr. Bing?
So back on the puzzle hunt, though, I wanted to inject one other improvement, which I'd like to see is much more tactical than the major thing, which is how do you deal with hints, and also whether you can get like one thing to make games broader is you introduce luck. How can you introduce luck into these games in a way which is satisfying to the players?
Ooh, interesting, and, controversial.
So with the hint, what I would like to see more often is something where it's a well understood process how the hints are going to be revealed, and you can spend some sort of resource perhaps to unlock extra hints, and you can do it at your own pace and things like that. So you treat the hints as sort of a resource in the game. which can is understood by the players how to manipulate rather than being given from on high. I've seen some hunts which do that, but I think that it could be the entire game.
Yeah, and that would certainly adding more luck into the things would help a lot. So anyway, there's a couple ways to approach it. My big thing would be, not make it competitive. Who cares if you, and there's so few things, like crossword puzzles are a great example, right? Crossword puzzles are really close. They're sort of like a mini puzzle hunt. Mm-hmm. You can look up stuff on the internet. A lot of people do look up stuff in dictionaries. A lot of people do that. And even before the internet, there was a time.
And, wait, what?
Yes, there was.
What?
And the thing is, nobody cares, no right? Way. With a cross, I know this is heresy, but it's actually the connectivity, which I think destroys these things in terms of their mass value.
Oh man, you are
sorry.
I'm a child of the internet age.
Yep. But if I had a canned puzzle hunt, which was 12 hours of fun for me and six friends to get together and do. And I just didn't care about whatever anyone else was doing. And if for me it's 6 hours, and with Richard's sort of hunt thing, if I'm not as good, then after a certain amount of time, hints start appearing, and I solve it in 8 hours instead of six because they appear at a certain rate. That's awesome. I mean, I would get together. I would have people over for an evening all the time to do maybe sixes along, a 3 hour mini mystery hunt. That would be awesome.
That would be fun.
And they could all be linked together into a year-long campaign.
Absolutely. Connectivity is evil.
With a narrative.
Because the closer...
I actually agree with you on the connectivity, even though I, mock because that's what I do. being the youngest person here, sort of have to. But I think that that's one way that you could equalize it, is to have a standard team size and not let anybody use the internet. And I think you'd be a lot closer than you would if you have tons.
There are some hunts which do that, and those are kind of interesting where you've got limited teams, you're in separate rooms, you're not using the internet, you're not using your cell phones or whatever, since those are the internet these days.
It's just what you know and what you can figure out.
Yep.
Old school.
Yeah, that's a... The only thing you need there then is you do need a solid system of automatic hints to move people along. So if you want it to go appeal to a broader audience.
Well,
so that problem's been solved.
Now that we've fixed that, do we want to move on to peace in the Middle East, or should we wrap it up for tonight?
Yeah, I think so. We're probably good.
All right. Well, thank you for listening, and we will be back with our next podcast talking about narrative. Until we see you next time, have a great month.
So long.
Or 2 weeks. Bye.